There will be a religious man who comes alongside the political man who will run the common market and the world trading system.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Bit of a U-turn from Trump last night as he becomes the ISIS Air Force in a 4 a.m. attack coordinated with ISIS on the ground. Here's Donald Trump bombs the Syrian government's Shayrat airbase near Homs in Syria. So what's the evidence Assad was behind Tuesday's chemical weapons attack, and why is he providing air support, Trump that is, for ISIS? Another apparent car attacker too in Stockholm today, three people dead. Is it an accident? Doesn't look like it. Yes, it's almost the daily round of terror attacks, but almost forgotten in all this is Russia's first terror attack since Volgograd in 2013. This week on the St. Petersburg Metro. It's killed double the number of people that were killed in London. Yes, what about that Westminster Bridge attack a couple of weeks ago? Alan Buttle is a Londoner who's livid about the media coverage of the Khalid Masood incident. Why is he so annoyed? Well, we'll take a close look tonight at that. All that's emerged about the Wednesday 22nd of March attack since it dropped out of the headlines. Plus, looking at modern events through the media, it's your truth, my truth, his truth and her truth. Whatever happened, though, to objective truth? Indian writer Ravi Zacharias believes there's been a deliberate plan through the centuries to bring us to the point where ancient ideas about right and wrong can be torn up and remoulded in a day. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, if Jesus was around today, would he drive a gold Mercedes? Well, we hear from street preaching pastor Francis Oviawe from the Body of Christ Church in Norwest, who does. Also, the latest on the Colombian peace process in South America and the Ecuador elections. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, Donald Trump sends 59 cruise missiles over to Syria to this airbase. And lucky he didn't hit any Russians, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know how many. Has anybody been killed? Do we know?
Yes, they have. Oh, yes,
so Syrian military personnel.
It's five people killed, Syrians, yeah.
How would the British government react if five of their military personnel had been killed in an airstrike? What do you think we'd do?
I think we'd probably be pretty annoyed about it. This happened all at 4 a.m. in the morning. One of the things which hasn't been reported either over here, almost at all, is the evidence from the local news agencies around there saying that there was an attack on this Shayrat airbase exactly at the same time on the ground from ISIS.
Well, is it ISIS that was it, or is it the other front rebels that supposedly control the area where the supposed gas attack has taken place? They certainly did fly air support for ISIS at Deir ez-Zor some months ago, where 80-some-odd Syrian military personnel were killed, conscript soldiers, mostly Sunnis, and ISIS was clearly coordinating with the RAF, because the RAF flew a drone from Waddington involved in that, and they killed 80 personnel. What do you think we'd do if the Syrian army killed 80 British military personnel in Britain? How would we react to that?
Well, the reason for it, of course, is this gas attack on Tuesday. So that seems to be the reason why this is all taking place.
Yes, well, the gas attack has been blamed on Assad without any investigation whatsoever.
50 adults, 20 children killed.
Well, so they say, but we're still trying to work out what exactly happened. The source for all the information that's being used here are the White Helmets and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is one guy based in Coventry, funded by the British government and others. The White Helmets were set up by British military officer James Le Mesurier. And they are also funded by NATO intelligence services, and they're embedded with the rebels, who are Al-Qaeda. Well, so the ultimate source for the information about this attack has come from Al-Qaeda. Do you remember the people that attacked the World Trade Center? They're the source of the information about this attack. And of course, as we know, Al-Qaeda are a perfectly legitimate source of information. They never tell lies. They're extremely reliable, just as reliable as they were 2 years ago when it turned out that the attack in Damascus, and it was investigated by Carlo Del Ponte for the UN, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Seymour Hirsch, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, Robert Parry.
And also Christoph Lehmann did a really in-depth report into that, which is the first time I've come across that.
And all the evidence showed that it was actually carried out by the rebels with the help of at least of the Turkish intelligence services, MIT, which are part of NATO. So in other words, what I would say about this is not only did Assad not carry out that previous attack, and probably not this one either, but that in actual fact, the rebels carried out the attack in collusion with NATO intelligence services.
Where are the
services.
Rebels going to get hold of sarin gas from, or the precursors?
From Libya. That's where the last lot came from. And of course, they're capable of manufacturing it because they're getting help and support from MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, and also NATO.
Something else which has been unreported, certainly as far as I've seen in the mainstream press in this part of the world from Tuesday's attack, is that there were two. This is Médecins Sans Frontières reporting this, that there were two different types of injuries and two different types of gas used in that attack. One was chlorine, the other one was this sarin, this particularly nasty nerve agent developed during the Second World War.
Yeah, well, the fact is that all of the facts are disputed at this stage. So for Trump to decide that he knows what happened and therefore that he's going to attack an airbase is A, as Putin has pointed out, that's not legal under international law because you haven't got any UN resolution. And it's not even legal under US law because he's supposed to go to Congress before he makes an act of war like that. That's in the Constitution. Now, what would happen, for example, if Trump, without going to Congress, I mean, it's possible that Congress would have backed him, although in actual fact what happened last time is they didn't back Obama, and that's why he had to back off. And, of course, Trump's base, the people who voted for him, voted for him on the understanding that he wasn't going to try regime change in Syria. That was one of the things he said he wasn't going to do. You could say, well, he's attacked this airbase now, and that's the end of it. He's made his point. But of course, it's quite possible. I don't think it would happen, but it's quite possible that the response by the Russians and the Syrians would be to sink the ship that went through it, which fired the missiles, and they can't get out of the Mediterranean. They could end up with a shooting war in the Mediterranean with loads of NATO ships sunk. And that could happen without going to Congress or whatever. I don't think that's what is going to happen. If Assad and Putin were as mad as they say, that is exactly what they would do.
Well, what the American generals are saying is that they could take out the whole Syrian Air Force in one night if they want.
I think that's bluster. I think that the Russian air defences there are quite capable of... and don't forget,
the Russian air defences didn't do anything about these cruise missiles, did they?
No, that's because the Americans told them in advance that they were going to hit this air base, and therefore the Russians wisely decided that they were just going to stand aside and let it happen. I think what the Russians and the Syrians will now do is stick to... Don't forget, they're winning the war. They've got no motive for carrying out this attack.
Now, what about, say, for example, these aircraft that dropped this alleged gas on Tuesday did come from this airbase. If that's true, why would you bomb an airbase when there may be sarin gas being stored there?
Well, it's making a political point, isn't it? Although five people are dead as far as we know. And as I said earlier, what would the British government do if five military personnel were killed in such an airstrike on your own territory? On British territory, that would have to happen.
Now, back in 2003, the Arab League said the invasion of Iraq will open the gates of hell. That was on a BBC webpage and was quickly changed after about an hour or so. I think they thought that was a bit too much of a strong headline. But effectively, Saddam was entrapped by April Glasby back in the first Gulf War. And it does seem as if, you know, the what's been happening in the Middle East, particularly since 2003, has been an absolute disaster. Almost every single time that there's an intervention, it just causes more death and mayhem. And effectively what's now happening is most people around the world are saying, well, Syria's borders are just kind of, well, we're just going to have to redraw them.
Well, as I've said often on this show, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Mitterrand, has been on French TV, and he said before the Arab Spring, before the uprising in Syria...
That was in 2009, he's saying, that this happened, and this was when David Miliband was the foreign secretary.
Yes, that's right. When David Miliband was the foreign secretary, it was one of the reasons why he didn't end up being Labour leader, because we don't trust him. He said, well, the British approached me, British officials approached me and said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Now, and do you want to join in? Now, the facts are pretty clear. The rebels inside Syria are extreme jihadists. They're Salafists, Wahhabis. They want to enforce Sharia law, and they're not interested in any other kind of version of Islam but their version. They are a minority. 60,000 to 70,000 of them come from outside Syria. They come from all over the place, from Libya, from Chechnya, and other places. And they've been armed, trained, and directed by NATO intelligence services based in Turkey and Jordan. Well, we started the war in Syria. There wasn't a war before the British and the Americans stuck their finger in. British military personnel are on the ground inside Syria, and hopefully the Syrian army are going to catch them and blow their brains out.
Well, what about the $100 million that was spent last night on cruise missiles? They're about $1.4 million each, these things, and they obviously have to be replaced, because the arms industry, when you get the arms industry quite close to government, then you start to wonder whether these decisions are just based on trying to make more money for the arms companies. Now, right now, we have Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain. Her husband, Philip May, is one of the directors of Capital Group, who are a major, major investor in several things, one of which is the arms industry. They're almost like a sort of mini Carlyle Group type company, Capital Group. They also invest in Big Pharma that do these vaccination programs. But you do wonder sometimes on these decisions of majors, who's wearing the trousers in that relationship? Is it Philip May or is it Theresa?
Well, that's another question. The role of the arms industry is pretty pernicious and always has been. Nevertheless, this precipitate decision, which, as I said earlier, Putin's already pointed out, it's not legal to attack without a UN Security Council resolution.
But what I'm trying to say is, are we getting decisions from our governments which actually represent some kind of logical, sensible, rational point of view, or is it just they're out there to make money?
No, they're not. They're not. And, of course, the difference between the Russians and the West is that the Russian arms industry is a nationalised industry. So they think very carefully about how much they want to spend and what they want to spend it on and what their goals actually are. And, in fact, the Russian parliament quite recently agreed that it was going to reduce defence spending. Because they can do that. You can't do that in the West.
Well, we've
also
heard this week soldiers from Wiltshire, other parts of this part of the country, being shipped over to Estonia. So we've had decades of this kind of peaceful thing, which is where we're bringing in these new countries, these seasoned new countries, this lovely little fun club called NATO. Now they're right up against the Russian border. They're now actually deploying into those countries.
They
British
are.
Troops.
They
US
are.
Troops.
And it's provocative. It's incredibly provocative, but I don't think there's any... The Russians aren't going to start a war. They don't care. If the British want to waste money marching around in Estonia, they can do whatever they like. What they do worry about is having these anti-missile missiles in Romania and elsewhere. And, of course, what really could happen here is that the Russians finally lose patience and say, right, well, we're just not going to negotiate with you anymore. We're just going to fight you, because that's all that's left to do.
The British Defence Secretary Michael Fallon was speaking on Five Live earlier on, where he explained why the US supported this action last night.
We're supporting it because we want to prevent the regime using chemical weapons against its own people in future and slaughtering children, as we saw in that appalling gas attack. This was a very limited but very appropriate response from the United States, targeting the airfield and the airplanes and the equipment that was used in this attack in order to deter the Syrian regime from doing anything like it again.
Well, there's no evidence, to my mind, to suggest that this regime was behind this attack. The previous attack was carried out by the rebels in order to try and bring in an airstrike. This one looks very similar to that one. And it's the same people giving us the information, the White Helmets and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, who are essentially propaganda outfits funded by NATO.
Michael Fallon was also asked, was the UK consulted?
We've been in very close contact with the American government at all levels over the last couple of days. I've spoken to my opposite number, the Defence Secretary, and our Prime Minister has been kept informed of those discussions throughout.
Well, we either weren't consulted or we were, and we said, let's go along with this. What particularly embitters me is the role of the RAF in the strike on Desert Zor, which was definitely in support of ISIS and was deliberately done to undermine negotiations going on between John Kerry and his opposite number, Lavrov. So we are actually deeply involved in the Syrian war. Britain was involved in starting the Syrian war.
But isn't something similar happening?
Our special forces have been,
Martin,
involved in training the terrorists.
Something similar happening today, because we've got the UN peace talks going on in Geneva just
indeed,
about to
start.
Indeed,
and that makes the timing of the whole thing so suspect. And of course, the other thing is that there's a faction within the military in the US who wants to force Trump's hand, force him into conflict with Russia, because they were worried that he might be able to talk some peace and sense. And they got that this is all now out of the window. So this is all great from their point of view. And of course, the rebels have got a similar interest.
The crucial question, of course, Michael Fallon has to answer is: is there actually any evidence that President Assad was behind this chemical attack on Tuesday?
We've shared our assessment with the Americans, who've done their own assessment, and we think it's highly likely that this was the regime. The regime has form in this area. It's used gas before against its own people, and it has continued to defy United Nations Security Council resolutions. And what's really important now is that we do deter the regime from carrying out further attacks in future. And that's the aim of this very limited, narrowly focused action the Americans took last night.
Well, the fact is that the previous chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, as we've said, the UN investigation, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Seymour Hersh, and various other people have all showed what happened there, and it's pretty clear that it wasn't the regime. Not only was it not the regime, it was the rebels, and the rebels working with NATO intelligence services, with sarin supplied from Libya.
But the Russians, we might upset the Russians here. What has Michael Fallon got to say about that?
The Russians have had every opportunity over the last 2 or 3 years to use their influence, and they have great influence over the regime, to use their influence to stop the regime attacking its own people, barrel bombing its own civilian population, using gas against its own people. You know, the Russians should be hanging their heads in shame. They should be using their influence to bring this civil war to an end.
Would you like to see a regime change in Syria?
We've always made it clear that there is no long-term future for President Assad in Syria. Somebody who's bombed his own civilians, who's been gassing his own civilians. There's no future for him. On the contrary, we want Syria to move to a more democratic settlement.
Well, President Assad stood in a democratic election in Syria and won overwhelmingly. And even NATO's internal intelligence report, which was leaked early in the conflict, suggested that he had the support of about 70% of the population. He's got the support of all the ethnic minorities, the Christians, for example, the Shia, the Alawites, they all support him. And a substantial section of the Sunni community supports him as well, including the Grand Mufti in Damascus, who's a very senior Sunni cleric. His son was assassinated by the moderate rebels who we are supporting. And of course, we are supporting those rebels. Those rebels are the ones that what they did at Ghouta was they took civilians who supported the regime, killed them, and then blamed the regime, which has been fairly standard practice from the beginning of the war. They kill people. Once people are dead, nobody knows what side they're on. So the rebels then show a picture of all these dead people, say, oh, they've been killed by the government. But in actual fact, they're some government supporters have been killed by the rebels. And they've been cooking up this stuff with the support of British Army intelligence officers like James Le Mesurier, who frankly should be executed.
Well, Martin's a little bit rough on the poor chap. But anyway, look, what about
not.
Michael Fallon? One of the things he was saying there was we need to get rid of Assad. But then what would happen after that? Let's have a look. Because, I mean, you would probably just be handing on the country to a bunch of different types of jihadis if Assad was gone. So Michael Fallon answered that question too.
Well, we have democracy now in Iraq, however fragile it is, and we have Iraqi armed forces, thanks to our help, now beginning to push Daesh terrorists out of all their cities. Only Mosul is left. We have to have the kind of government we've got in Iraq, which represents Shia and Sunni, can represent all the different factions. It's a fragile democracy in Iraq, I grant you that, but there is no future in Syria to be led by a dictator who's prepared to gas his own people.
It's absolute humbug. In actual fact, the coalition airstrikes in Iraq have been killing far more civilians than the very targeted strikes carried out by the Russians and the Syrians. Assad is by far the most popular politician in Syria. He was quite unpopular at the beginning of the Arab Spring because he was in place and the people didn't like him. But in actual fact, many of the people who originally opposed him have come around to supporting him as basically an Abraham Lincoln kind of figure holding the country together against people who are trying to undermine it. If there is a democratic election in Syria and the Russians and the Syrians have said we're perfectly prepared to have a UN-supervised election, Assad has got to be allowed to stand because Assad's the most popular politician in the country. Can anybody on the British or American side name a single politician in Syria who could beat Assad in an election? And of course, they can't.
What's the point of Britain and US supporting this kind of action? Because it really only seems to benefit Israeli foreign policy.
Well, they're the ones who of course have got their own interests in the Yinon plan of destabilising their neighbours. They want to seize the Golan Heights because they've got oil in them. And in any case, the whole problem is that they want to the Saudis wanted to build an oil pipeline through Syria to Turkey, and of course the Syrians wanted to build an oil pipeline from Iran to Syria to supply the European market. And so underlying all of this is the usual geopolitics of oil and money. And the Western powers have tried to overthrow the Ba'athist regime in Syria several times. They've always failed, because ultimately you can't win a war like the one in Syria if you don't have popular support. The Syrian Arab Army has taken 160,000 casualties, I think, and they've managed to carry on fighting. That's because they believe in winning, and they're not going to give in until they have won. And there's no way that the West is going to win this, no matter how hard they huff and puff and no matter how strong they get. If it comes to an absolute straight-down fight, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the US and British navies in the Gulf and in the Mediterranean.
Well, one thing's for sure, the people of Iraq and Syria will lose.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And we change the subject now to look at the Westminster Bridge attack a couple of weeks ago. And I'm joined on the line by someone who made a film. He's from London, Alan Buttle. Hi, Alan. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
First of all, just tell us a bit about why you decided to actually get down on your computer and make a little film about this and stick it on YouTube.
Well, I just think there's such little proper investigative journalism happening in the mainstream media. And I think we just need as many people as possible sort of going through all the details sort of with a fine tooth comb and trying to find the inconsistencies in the story, because the mainstream media do an atrocious job at resolving these inconsistencies.
Was there anything particularly that you saw about the way that this was covered where you thought, I just don't believe that? Quite a lot of people do things like throw things at the television, switch it off. What was the one thing for you, if there was one?
Well, whenever I see an event like this that gets such saturated media coverage from the very start, I ask questions straight away, because we've seen with previous false flag attacks like 9/11, for example, being the most famous, all the media are ready to tell the same story straight away. So, and it saturates the entire media. There's nothing else in the news, and this was the case with Westminster. And so I was intrigued at the outset, and then sort of analyse the evidence as it started to come in.
Well, okay, I asked you that question because I'm also going to ask the same question of myself, and maybe Martin too, because for me it was a report on the BBC, live report. One of the first reporters to the scene for BBC television was Daniel Sandford, and here's that report, because this was almost one of the first things that anyone was switched on the TV that day would have seen. But some of the things that were being said I found really quite surprising. Anyway, let's have a little listen to this report now from Daniel Sandford on the day.
Well, we're starting to get a picture of what may have happened. From talking to eyewitnesses here at Scotland Yard, which is only 100 metres from the heart of the incident, it sounds as if a vehicle drove over Westminster Bridge at high speed, knocking people down. We've had eyewitnesses describing to us possibly 8 people lying on Westminster Bridge. Somebody somehow ended up actually in the River Thames itself, possibly as part of that incident. A vehicle then seems to have run itself up against the Palace of Westminster, and we're hearing reports of two different possible assailants. One has been described to me by eyewitnesses as a white person, possibly with bald hair, carrying what looked to be two large knives. And a second one, which seems to be the man being arrested by police in Old Palace Yard, appears to be a black man with a goatee beard. And talking to police officers around here, there does seem to be a feeling that there may have been two people in the vehicle. So a possible, and I stress at this stage, a possible picture of a vehicle with two people in it, one black, one white, mowing people down on Westminster Bridge, and then people inside then trying to get inside the Palace of Westminster itself.
Well, that could be just maybe spurious eyewitness coming along saying something which simply isn't true. But Daniel Sanford there actually does say that even the police were saying that it looked like that there were two suspects. One was a white, bald man, another one, black man with a goatee beard, both in the car. Now, this is a little bit not what we've been told, Martin, is it?
No, it isn't. And of course, what people would say, well, there must be CCTV, somebody must have checked up on it, we now know what happened. But we know what happens in previous incidents like this. A media narrative is established, and then everybody sings from the same hymn sheet. So on 7/7, for example, Mark Honingsbaum, who was a Guardian journalist, started reporting outside Edgware Road, I think, and he said what people were saying, that the bombs were under the trains, that the train was derailed by a bomb underneath it. Then, of course, later on, it was all about rucksack bombs, etc. Now, because we know that the NATO intelligence services do engage in false flag terrorism, like the Bologna bombing in 1980 or the Piazza Fontana bombing in 1969 in Milan. We know that they do these things. So the first question has always got to be in an incident like this, is this for real or is this a false flag? And that's a perfectly legitimate question.
So the question is, whatever happened to bald white man? Or was he just some sort of ghost figment of the police?
Well, he might have been the handler for the other chap.
Was he actually the driver of the car?
Well, potentially? We don't know, do we?
Now, this really leads me to, for me, which is the key point, which is this new shoot-to-kill policy, it seems, that we've got in Britain. Like Yasser Yacoub, he was the guy who was shot on the M62 on the 2nd of January. His driver, Moshin Amin, is actually standing trial for possession of a firearm. It doesn't look, certainly on the evidence at the moment, that Yasser Yacoub actually even was armed, personally armed himself. And yet he was shot dead by the police on the scene. The same exact thing has happened in the Westminster attacks. Alan, what do you want to run through some of the things that you think have stood out in your analysis that you think haven't been properly reported?
Right, well, basically we're dealing with an event that should have a great deal of evidence. Obviously happening right outside the Houses of Parliament in the middle of the day. Normally tourists, cameras are already trained on Parliament, so you would expect many people to gather footage and upload it to the internet, but actually we have none at all. The only video that's been taken that shows the aftermath taken from the bridge is by the ex-Polish Defence Secretary, Radoslaw Sikorski. So that's a very ominous...
Yeah, and you quite rightly pointed out that he's also a former Bullingdon Club member.
That's right, yes, alongside David Cameron and Boris Johnson, of course. So, you know, we wouldn't necessarily trust him from the outset. And many of the eyewitnesses gave very differing accounts. There were two women that said on film that they saw people getting shot on Westminster Bridge. And there were other reports of a policeman tally with the official story that comes out afterwards. We've also got the matter of the photographers that managed to capture the very crystal clear photos of the event for the newspapers.
Well, I've got a little clip actually now about that you did as part of your film, and if you could just manage to find a little bit slightly better mobile coverage, because you've been dropping out there, Alan. In the meantime, I'll just play a little clip from the film that you put up online, which does talk about these various different the interesting photographers that were there.
Now I'll introduce you to the photographers of this event. Toby Melville won the Reuters Photographer of the Year in 2010. If you search for his name, you will find hundreds of photos that he has taken for the mainstream media. He also just happened to be there in exactly the right place to take photos for the newspapers at the Westminster terror attack. His photos are mostly situated on the bridge. These two photographs of Toby Melville's are particularly interesting. They seem to show a dead body under a bus, but the body doesn't seem to fit with the story that has just been run over. There is no blood, no visible injuries, and the body shape seems wrong if we're supposed to believe this person had just been run over by a bus which weighs over 12 tons. Also, where are the people around this body? Had they already given up this person for dead? Why isn't anyone trying to help? There was enough time for Melville to take two photos from different angles, one of them seeming to show a policeman walking right past unbothered. This is the other main photographer of the event, Stéphane Rousseau. Another photographer, Carl Court, Guardian Photographer of the Year 2016, was right there to take some more photos from the bridge. To have these photographers ready right at the very moment of this event seems to be more than a coincidence, especially when you consider that hardly any other photographs of the event exist other than taken by these photographers. We should have learnt by now that the government and the corporate media are compromised. They are dominated by the kind of interests that demand more globalisation, more war, and less human freedom. We have to ask ourselves what the evidence is for this event, and currently we are expected to believe it based only upon a few quite varied eyewitness accounts, a few really unclear, inconclusive videos, and the words of some official and corporate media talking heads. This is not good enough. We need to remain sceptical until there is sufficient evidence in front of us, until we can resolve all the inconsistencies. Until then, we have to keep in mind that it could be very different from how it is being reported. We need to keep open-minded to all possibilities until we can prove that they are impossible. It's also worth mentioning, I think, that this latest attack involving a motor vehicle comes after similar supposed attacks in Nice, Berlin and Jerusalem. The official stories of these events also don't stand up to serious scrutiny, so we have to also conclude that there is a reason why they have chosen to have vehicles play a part in many of the recent attacks, likely because eventually they will want to automise all motor vehicles, which will enable them to gain further control and gather more information about us.
Well, to a certain extent, these vehicles do seem to almost drive themselves sometimes. I mean, we were reading recently about the Mercedes of Michael Hastings that was sped up to 80 miles an hour and crashed over in the United States. But Alan, I mean, at the end of the day, surely the biggest thing here is that we're not going to have a court case now this guy has been shot dead.
Yeah, that's right. As you correctly state, this is becoming routine, and I think we have become used to it from what we've seen happening in the United States, where there's often a lone suspect that ends up getting killed by the authorities before they can be put on trial. It's very convenient.
Well, it also reflects what happened to Jean-Charles de Menezes, the electrician that was shot dead, executed, some say, on a tube train by the police just after the 7/7 London bombings, too.
That's right, yeah. And the person in charge of that operation, Chrissy de Dick, now is the head of the Met. So, you know, it didn't do her career too much harm.
Now, I know, Martin, you're actually quite a supporter of the whole shoot-to-kill policy, aren't you?
Well, what I would say is that once you actually open fire, you don't shoot to wound. Nobody does. You shoot to kill.
But what about with the taser, for example?
Well, the taser's supposedly not to kill anybody anyway.
Oh, well, can you not shoot somebody to bring them down rather than to kill them?
You can,
have to shoot somebody in the chest, do you?
Well, I would just put it to you this way. People who are trained to use firearms always shoot to kill. There's still a question about what... all the questions about this still remain to be answered. For example, he was still alive when he was taken to the hospital, yeah? So he died. He didn't die immediately anyway, even though he was shot to kill.
The other thing, of course, it does when you kill a suspect, whether it's Menezes, Yasser Yacoub, or this chap in the Westminster attacks, is that the media have then got carte blanche to say absolutely anything they want about him, because otherwise they've got to be quite careful, because they may then get sued. Once he's dead, he can't sue them for libel. They can make up anything about him at all, whether it's true or not, and they don't have any kind of legal problems.
I think what people find difficult to understand is why people would kill themselves or allow themselves to be killed carrying out these attacks. They must be genuine. Now, in actual fact, I believe that the Islamist networks in which these individuals are radicalised are actually being run by the intelligence services. We've seen this before. The Red Brigades were infiltrated by the intelligence services, and the so-called Red Brigades kidnapped the Prime Minister of Italy, Aldo Moro, and executed him. Although, in actual fact, subsequent investigation by the police, including Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, showed that it was, in fact, NATO intelligence services.
But he wasn't an Islamic terrorist, was
no,
he?
No, but the point I'm making is this, is that when we see Islamist terrorists carrying out these acts, if that's what they are, they themselves may be puppets of the intelligence services, whether they realise it or not. And that is the fundamental way in which NATO false flags have been working for 30 or 40
years. And, of course,
years. The evidence of the past tells against the future.
Sorry, Alan.
This Khalid Massoud, he was known to go on large drug and sex binges and this kind of thing, for example. So he was definitely not living a pure Islamist lifestyle.
No, he was also known as a violent criminal, of extremely violent chap.
Absolutely, and one that has had contact with the authorities before and that have followed him before. He seemed like the perfect kind of guy to recruit to go through with it, one of these kind of things. That would be my estimation. He seems far more likely to be a police informant recruit than an Islamic fundamentalist terrorist.
There's another couple of aspects to this. One is the lack of an armed police actually on the outside gates of Parliament, and the other is the lack of CCTV coverage. Well, the armed police were dropped from parliamentary duties in January this year. There are two reasons that have been given for that, which always makes me a bit suspicious when people can't get their story straight. There are two reasons. One is because the police were too exposed on the gates of Parliament. Well, that is really laughable, because if you're going to use that argument, then you will take all armed guards off of all army bases, Air Force bases and naval bases as well. And then also the other reason given was that the MPs just felt intimidated by them. So no one seems to be able to get their story straight on why the police were removed 2 months ago. I imagine they're back now, but that was very convenient because it allowed Mahoud to get into that area without being challenged with a firearm if he had knives on him, etc. Also, the Westminster CCTV was switched off in June last year, apparently due to lack of funds, although Westminster Council is one of the richest in the country.
Yes, it's completely laughable. There's just no way, you know, Westminster would switch off their CCTV cameras to save a few, you know, say £5 or something, when, you know, the whole place is full of billionaires. It's a complete joke. I agree with you completely. It seems like they removed the armed police from that point in order to have cover your excuses already before in preparation of conducting this staged event.
It does look like it, potentially. Anyway, look, also Simon Israel on Channel 4 News, the Channel 4 News' MI5 correspondent, he wrongly named Abu Izzadeen as the terrorist. So it does look as if there's certain disinformation, untrustworthy, coming from the security services. Martin, it does seem that there's a lot of very, very close relations between the security service and journalists. We've heard this from Annie Machon, where actually what they do is they simply place their own stories in the press as if the news people are making those stories up themselves. And if you don't cooperate as a senior London media journalist with MI5, you find that you don't get any stories and you might even lose your job.
Well, there's the German chap, wasn't there, who was died recently, who said, well, I worked for the CIA for years and years and years, and I'm not the only one. And
he was working for a national German newspaper, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung.
Yeah. I mean, unless you can control the narrative after events like this, there's no point the intelligence services running these false flags.
We also heard, of course, that Mahoud was a lone wolf. That was said for the first few days, and yet there were a whole load of arrests of his associates in Birmingham.
Well, yes, I mean, whenever these incidents happen, it's obviously going to take a while for anybody to find out what has actually happened, a bit like this chemical weapons attack we were discussing earlier in the show. But I come back to my fundamental point, which is we have documentary evidence from the Italian Supreme Court and from the Irish Supreme Court, for example, that NATO intelligence services do indeed engage in false flag terrorism. And I mentioned Bologna railway station bomb in 1980, killed 86 people. I think anybody who investigates that now knows that the Italian police have proved beyond any doubt that NATO were behind
that attack.
But
this, Martin, is London. This is not Bologna, is it?
No, but Bologna is part of NATO.
And that was a long time ago.
No, but that's the point I'm making, Tony. It's such a long time ago, and that therefore we know that that's what they were doing in 1980. Why do we presume in 2017 that they've stopped doing these things?
Also,
and I would say that we don't. And in actual fact, the presumption has got to be that they still are.
Khalid Massoud, well, we were looking for his connections around the world as well, and found that he had no connections with Iran, Syria or Iraq or anywhere like that. No, it was all connected with Saudi Arabia. He had been over there teaching several times.
Yes, indeed. And the Saudis, of course, are the biggest funders of terrorism of the Salafi jihadi kind in the world. And they worked very closely with the British intelligence services and special forces in the 1980s. And then, of course, they went wild and carried out an attack on 9/11. And suddenly we realised that we shouldn't have been helping these people. But in actual fact, I think we were helping them then. We're still helping them now. I'll bet you the SAS are training jihadis in Jordan as we speak, paid for by our taxes.
We're not in Iran, then?
Well, their name is inside Iran as well. But, of course, the Iranians are pretty aware that's a danger, and they're pretty vigilant about it.
OK. Just to give other points of view, someone who was also, I was quite surprised to see, on the scene as this was happening, whilst the ambulances were still taking people away from the scene, was the former EDL chap, Tommy Robinson. Oh. So let's have a listen to what Tommy had to say from the scene of the attack at Westminster Bridge a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I know it's probably not the right time or place. People are probably lying there dying. Yeah? We've had 12 terrorist attacks stopped last year. When will the general public wake up to understand we're a f***ing war? The enemy are in our country and you're inviting more of them. You want more of them. You want them to have more power. You want to stop people with ability to criticise and speak up. When are you going to realise that? When will the politicians realise that? This is just what people have been waiting for. Look in the background. It's only a matter of time. There were 4 terrorist attacks last year or planned last week in Paris, in France. Just 4 last week. 4 last week. You don't even hear about it anymore. At no point should any of us, in any of our Western countries, in anywhere in Europe, be putting up with this backward jihad by barbarians that have been imported by our politicians. Imported and protected. And again, for Sky News, we're reporting an Asian. He wasn't f***ing Asian, he's a Muslim, on a jihad. I don't know the facts. Obviously, it takes a while for all the facts to come out in an instant like this, but all we know is a 4x4 was driving along the bridge, mowing down people. I've heard there's a possibility 3 are dead, up to 12 are injured. He then ploughed into the Houses of Parliament, and I believe he was shot. He got out with a machete or a knife. And this is it. Guaranteed already, yeah? The facts will come out, but the facts will be that this man was known to our intelligence services. Guys, the facts will be back, please, that the warnings have been there on this individual. Now, when we're at war, you need to, in turn, the people who are at war with us, who you know are at war with us, rather than waiting them to commit acts of terrorism like this, waiting them for going to murder innocent British people in the streets of our capital city like this.
Well, it's the voice of former EDL leader Tommy Robinson there, actually at the scene at the Westminster attacks 2 weeks ago.
What a coincidence, because he is former EDL leader, because he entered the Quilliam Foundation, who are, again, an intelligence service front to my mind, and then he rescinded his previous views and he became a moderate voice.
Look, what about the points he's making?
He may very well be right. It may very well be the case that these people were on the radar of the intelligence services, and that what I have to say to Tommy, it's because the intelligence services are running the Islamic Jihad in Syria and elsewhere, just as they were running the loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland.
He's saying there's a war on. Surely we have to respond to that.
Well, indeed, we have to respond to that, because the intelligence services are killing us using jihadis and using right-wing terrorists. They're trying to create a strategy of tension. And maybe if the IRA was still operating, the way to deal with people like Tommy with his extreme views is to take the war to Tommy. But I don't approve of that.
Anyway, Alan, you were trying to speak there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Tommy Robinson's a plant. I think he's there to stir up racial division and to distract people from actually looking into the specific details of the event. He always recites the official story of the event as if it's true and then takes that and then furthers his own agenda.
Perhaps it is true.
Well, I don't think he knows that it's true. I don't think we've seen the evidence to suggest that it's true. And I think that his point about this guy was known to the police, well, this is something that they do with many of these staged events. They make that a part of the story, so then people afterwards are crying out for more money for the intelligence agencies because, you know, if we could have tracked one more person, then we might have stopped the terrorist event.
Well, no, one of the main aspects of this, one of the fascinating things for me, little, you talking about the details, you're absolutely right. This is what will convict people if in court or not, if they are still alive at the end of the day, to actually say what had happened in the run-up to an attack, as Khalid Massoud is not, then it is the two clean knives which were photographed on the floor. I just looked at that and I thought, this is very much like the IDF Israeli Defence Force murder of Abdel Fattah al-Sharif in Hebron in March last year. The Israeli Defence Force Sergeant Elor Azaria is now serving an 18-month sentence for that murder, which seems a very lenient sentence for murder, 18 months. But anyway, it looks like he might get out early for it. So what do you make of the appearance of these knives with no blood on them, seem perfectly clean, sort of just dropped on the floor near the body of the so-called terrorist?
Well, again, it's just these little details that on their own don't really prove anything, but when you've got a lot of them, it's hard to explain away the coincidence. That, you know, we're expected to believe a lot of coincidences with this event. I mean, to be honest, there isn't even the evidence that any car drove down hitting people that would stand up in a court of law. There's no video, most of the eyewitness testimonies don't say that they saw a car at all. The level of scrutiny that the mainstream media gets up to is nothing compared to what would have to pass in a court of law.
And what about the initial reports of these two people in the car? That seems to have just been completely forgotten about, and of course it won't be looked at in court at all.
Well, like the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, there were reports of two, and then suddenly it was one, and then the story was one, and that was it. It's happened before.
Also, this attack was claimed by ISIS, apparently, but that's a very strange thing in itself, because you have two news agencies. I think it's called AXA, one of them, and I'll put a link to this on our show page, and the other one is Site News Agency, and ISIS have actually over the years distanced themselves from both news agencies, saying, well, quite a lot of the things that these news agencies are putting out has nothing to do with us. And yet when that news agency claims an attack for ISIS, immediately it goes all the way around the world that it's an ISIS attack.
Well, I mean, Site are a very odd organisation anyway. That's run by Rita Katz, isn't it?
Indeed.
They were broadcasting the beheading videos of James Wright Foley and Stephen Sotloff, and though when there was this propaganda campaign of these fake beheading videos, and Site were the ones that were releasing these videos even before ISIS had.
Alan, I just wondered if you could just give us and our listeners some tips on when there is some kind of terrorist event, when we've had several this week, particularly here on the home territory, how you can try and assess it. How do you know whether something is the way we're being told by the BBC, by ITN, by Channel 4, by Sky, or not?
Well, I just think we should judge everything based on the evidence that we can see, because I think we've seen over many, many decades that the mainstream media, especially, you know, becoming more extreme to the current day, is untrustworthy, and they will lie as a matter of course. And so we have to be our own detectives and come to our own conclusions. And thankfully, there are a lot of very, very good independent journalists out there doing the job that the mainstream media should be doing. But one thing I look for straight away is saturated media coverage, because if they're going to stage an event and they've got the media on board, the whole point of the event is to get that message across in the media as big as possible and as powerfully as possible to the people. So for any of the staged events, you would expect to see saturated media footage, even if the event doesn't seem to warrant it. Like, for example, it didn't kill that many people. You would still see saturated coverage.
Okay, Alan, well, you're just dropping out a little bit there. But anyway, look, thanks ever so much for joining us here on The Politics Show. And I'll put a link up to your video on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Thanks a lot, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So, Martin, I should really ask you the same thing. What's your tip for, reading between the lines, getting through the propaganda, that kind of thing?
Well, obviously, start with a sceptical attitude. That would be my fundamental point. Tommy Robinson there going on about jihadis and this, that and the other. He's got no historical knowledge at all. The fact is that NATO intelligence services over many years have engaged in false flag terrorism. It's proven. The Italian police have proven it. Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book that came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, and which showed beyond any doubt that NATO does engage in these kind of terrorist attacks. So the first thing you've got to say is when an attack like this happens is it a false flag attack? And of course, they've been working very closely with jihadis, particularly of a Saudi orientation, since the 1980s. So that's for 30, 40 years. And why isn't it that they don't catch these people? It's because they're working for the intelligence.
Well, I can tell you one thing is there's a certain amount of confusion over whether it's possible to present lies as fact, the truth, etc. And it does seem as if there's quite a lot of stuff coming through the mainstream media nowadays where we're basically just being told what to believe without actually being shown both sides, but without any balance. One of the people who's been looking into this kind of postmodern situation is the Indian writer Ravi Zacharias.
If you go back across the five centuries, in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, all the way down to the last century, the 20th century, first it was rationalism stern. I think, therefore I am. You wanted to hold to your beliefs with indubitable rational certainty. But on the heels of that, the empiricists came along, that the only world you can really speak with certainty is the phenomenal world, but you can empirically verify, and logical positivism was being birthed, and the ideas of reality were then framed in this sort of scientific single vision. So from rationalism, we moved on to empiricism. Empiricism gradually gave way, and in the 1800s, Darwin, with his Origin of Species and so on, began to ground it all within a naturalistic framework.
And we'll have a bit more from Ravi next week. But that's all. It's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up is Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Labour Councillor for Lochlea's Estella Ticknell, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers there, of course, as well. Our sister show, Dialects, here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday, or you can get the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Also, download MP3s there to listen to in the car. Follow story links and browse our archive. Our show page on this show for your comments is one word this week. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain's Arts Show tomorrow at 10 a.m. until 12. Also, if you're like me, today's music doesn't pass muster. Get the real deal Sunday evening 7 till 8 with Danny Lopsch. Do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'll leave you with some music from 1999, Apollo 440, and a call to action perhaps about stopping the rot. Certainly a worthy cause.
Can't stop the rock, you can't stop. to the groovy.